Ken, you and I both have spoken at great length about how many mysteries of the unknown and unexplained captivated us when we were kids, and some of those mysteries remain unexplained. We were talking about the Bermuda Triangle just the other day. Whatever happened with that? Did we just decide to stop investigating it after all of those planes and ships disappeared? Well, you probably enjoy, as I do, Expedition Unknown, a television show that's now starting its 13th season on Discovery. And lucky for us, there's a podcast called Expedition Unknown, where the host, Josh Gates, investigates unsolved, iconic stories across the globe. This is right out of our playbook. With direct audio from the hit TV show, we'll hear Gates explore stories like the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which we've talked about on our show, to the location of Captain Morgan's treasure in Panama, which, as far as I know, we have never talked about on our show. But these authentic, roughshod journeys help Gates separate fact from fiction and learn the truth behind compelling stories. And wait for it, he investigates the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. His investigation led him to the ocean floor, to the skies above, and even the edge of space to tackle some of the most intriguing disappearances in history. And this is what I've been saying to you, Ken. It isn't just the ocean floor. It goes to the very edge of space. And in the conclusion of his epic investigation, Josh used cutting-edge technology to investigate the Triangle's most infamous shipwrecks and lost flights. Will he find answers to just how the Triangle works, or will it forever remain a mystery? Tune in to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 424.JB0412, certificate number 37914, the Erica typewriter.
Typewriter.
Yeah, I'm going to say typewriter as four syllables, I've just decided.
I literally like it.
Turning over a new leaf.
The Erica typewriter.
Typewriter.
I always pronounce the first C in Arctic.
That's correct. Well, if you say Arctic, you just sound like a mouth breather.
but there's a street in Anchorage called Arctic Boulevard. No one pronounces the C in it. Arctic Boulevard.
They don't pronounce even the second one? They're like Arctic Boulevard.
You can't hear the second C because the wind is blowing so hard. But I even call the street Arctic, and I sound like an out-of-towner. This is a show. Today's show is just an opportunity for me. I've given myself an opportunity to say the word Soviet 50 times. So let's get it out of the way that there's no other point to it.
Now that I've said typewriter, I can't even complain.
Soviet typewriter.
Pronunciation is out the window or the window.
Finger guns. We live in a time when, ostensibly, we would say that there were no restrictions on what we could read or promulgate, right? You could write anything you wanted into one of your books, publish it, you would be, you know, you're certainly going to get critical pushback,
criticized by readers.
Right. People are going to be mad at you, but there's nothing prohibiting you from saying anything you want in American society.
And we treat that as absolute in American society. Like everything else is secondary to, I can put whatever I want in my book.
Although it's popular right now for people culturally to suggest that there is censorship in the United States, or as we say, censorship, and that people, you know, that they're culturally restricted in what they can say, and oh, you're going to get in trouble, you're going to get canceled, but that's just people kvetching that their opinions aren't popular.
Yes.
It's or
that they're getting made fun of.
Right. That people are it's just that they're mad that people are critical of what they've written. There's no actual prohibition.
The secret police coming to their door to them is people calling them a goon online.
Right.
And, you know, as I've said before, all these people complaining about censorship are typically doing it from the top-rated cable news program in America or something. So the censorship seems a little less effective than you would think.
Can you imagine what it would be like to live in it? Because there are plenty of places in the world today where there's actual state censorship of whole topics, whole genres.
A billion Chinese people right now
cannot access the free internet.
They have a version of the internet that will filter out things they're not supposed to be looking up or posting. I kind of need that, actually. I'm going to start using Alibaba. Just so it's like, are you sure you want to post that?
I definitely am doing a thing that I think is more and more common, which is, yeah, like self-restricting access to information.
You're the party.
Yeah, I am the party.
Everybody said you're the party, like for a long time, but now you are the party.
I'm the party. What do you think your if there were restrictions on what you could read, what do you think they would be primarily? I mean, I'm not primarily, but first, in the event of an American autocracy,
what's the most likely?
What's the first thing they would censure? All those gay marriage texts. I mean, I'm trying to imagine an autocracy here, and it could really come from anywhere on a political spectrum.
Yeah, that's what I'm like. I don't really want to commit myself to what ideology is more likely to do, because I think it's always a boogeyman.
Right.
I mean, if your question is, does Huckleberry Finn do the racial slurs in Huckleberry Finn get censored before the atheism in I don't know what's the right even going to censor?
Well, it's interesting that your first instinct is novels, right? That novels would be censured or censored.
Or both.
Or both.
First they're going to censure them. Then they're going to censor them.
Then they're going to censor them. But of course, there's all kinds of writing and shared ideas that aren't just novels and poetry.
It could be an evolutionary textbook that is no longer, I mean, is it censorship if a school district gets rid of it? You could still get the book.
The
school library might not have it.
Different kinds of censorship, right? Depending on what your if the only like access to books you have in practice is what's in your local library,
which is true.
You can get it somewhere.
Exactly.
Less effective.
Although in the Amazon age, that goes away less. That kind of geographical argument is maybe more relevant to an issue like abortion or healthcare, where, you know, you don't want your Amazon delivery guy giving you a colonoscopy, or at least I don't.
Oh.
But you look a little interested.
Have you had a colonoscopy?
I haven't seen your Amazon delivery guy. I mean, we don't want to give the future the impression that the entire 21st century is a absolutist free speech paradise, because even other Western democracies have more limitations than we do. You know, our the British press.
The UK libel laws are a lot stricter than ours.
Yes, and the national security, or at least the intersections of national security and free press, tend to favor the government more there.
Germans and Central Europeans have very strict anti-fascist publication laws, and also they don't like Scientology.
Right. correctly, they have seen that the two great threats to civilization are Nazism and Tom Cruise.
Right.
Even Canada, I think, has different, has kind of less absolutist, free, maybe in the defamation.
Oh, you can, and also about. No swears. You can't swear in Canada.
They don't even know the swears. Yeah. If you put a swear in a Canadian book, they're like, hey, what's all this? You know, they've never seen those words.
It's just like Fnord. They see a swear and they're
They cross
like,
the border and they go in the first service station restroom and they don't even know what they're looking at. It's like strange runes.
I think there's a tendency in the West to think that that most of the censorship that happened in especially mid-20th century Soviet Union was political censorship, censoring ideas, censoring resistance or
it wasn't. They were just
dissidents.
They were pixelating cleavage in Three's Company.
Well, no.
What if that was their main kind of censorship? we'll give you MTV, but
everything gets pixelated. You know, the Soviets were pretty pro sex. Actually, they weren't
prudes.
Yeah, they weren't prudes.
That's what I always say about them.
you needed to be having sex on behalf of the state. You couldn't be getting personal pleasure from it.
If you're topless, you need to be on a tractor. Then it's okay.
But some of the original kind of some of the censorship that happened in the mid-century was, and I'm talking particularly like kind of right after World War II, it was ideological in a kind of broader sense that Western decadence was the thing that you needed to be on the watch for. There actually wasn't much. Or anti-socialist political activity wasn't really that much of a bugbear.
They're not worried about subversion.
No, because most of the, you know, even the intellectuals, even what you would think of as the resistance, they were all pretty pro-socialist. It was, you can't get more left than socialism, right? So the resistance was either going to be reactionary, you know, pro-Slavic nationalism, or something else. And the danger, the perceived danger, was bourgeois values.
And cynically looking back, it seems like the aim becomes, at least as we get into the 50s and 60s, to shield the population from the knowledge that the West is actually doing great with their decadent bourgeois society.
That happened. You know, that was the thing that sort of came in gradually.
But at the beginning, that's not the case. Everybody's still real rah-rah about the potential of world revolution, so.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a lot of global knowledge that Stalin had purged 30 million people. You know, Stalin was not, like, beloved.
But you couldn't go to the Soviet bookstore and get a book called Stalin Has Purged 30 Million People.
You certainly couldn't.
I mean,
but also
it's
I
not
think
a great title.
Within the USSR, there was a feeling that they had won World War II, that they'd defeated fascism, and that they were the ones that were not just technologically advanced, but they were
ideologically ascendant.
Yeah, right. And I mean, because
we're the future.
They had a much more, you know, sort of progressive civil rights. At least on the surface.
We're good on women. They're good on ethnic minorities. They're not
bad,
really.
Bad but. On Jews and also like, you know, like the Crimeans and Ukrainians and every, you know, they're not. But if you, but you could put a, because the Soviet Union encompassed such a broad geographical area, they just had so many different peoples that you could do one of those We Are the World posters with people from, you know, spanning the globe, basically.
And you could still oppress 6 to 9 of them.
And then
you still have a few left in peasant garb for the posters.
But it didn't look like colonialism because everyone wanted a socialist future. The danger was creeping bourgeois values. And, you know, this was one of the things that the Nazis were afraid of, too. You know, the Nazis, one of the things, I mean, they singled out the Jews because, you know, that's an ancient practice. But one of the ways that they felt that the Jews were undermining the Germans was that they were bringing in all this culture.
Modern art.
Jazz. That's right. Modern art. And so, and that was the thing that was,
You can't run a revolution with cubism knocking at the door.
Exactly.
Who's going to win, guns or cubism?
It's the, you know, it's the sense of moral decay. And in the,
well, that's kind of analogous to many 21st century culture wars.
It really is. Right. And
we still see the same thing today. You know, normally we're for all these protections, but we have an unprecedented threat. And, you know, if it's 1989, that threat is gangster rap.
Right.
You know?
And if it's now, it is, wokeness or whatever it is that, it's Black Lives Matter. It's undermining our culture, yeah. Right? But the flip side too, not to be a both sides type, because you know I'm not. I'm a one sides type.
And you just need to say what the side is now.
I'm not going to say it.
But you agree? You disagree with all the others.
But in that era, that you know, Stalin Khrushchev turnover period, but in the waning days of Stalin,
yeah.
There was a fear that, or the thing that they were watching out for more than anything was the idea that that individuality was a threat to the collective good of the Soviet state, that to just sort of privilege the individual, and that's very different from now in the United States, right? Nobody, very few people are going to censor you for being too individualistic. But Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak was one of the first books to be censured, not because there's anything in it that politically questions the socialist system.
It's a vibe.
The
Chicago just hits different.
The book is about the personal struggles of the main characters, and so in so doing, it was perceived to not advance the story of the Soviet state. It was a novel. It was about these individual people and their personal struggles, and that alone was considered bourgeois.
That's scary as a creator because it's so nebulous and, you know, has the potential to be really wielded post hoc. You know, I feel like today I understand what things I say will get me in trouble. I shouldn't say something transphobic because I know I will hear from it from the left, and if I want to appeal to the right, I shouldn't say things that celebrate pluralism or evolution or vaccination.
Never say communities of color.
Exactly. Don't say vaccinations work, or you'll hear from the right. But if it's just a vibe that the state is going to decide, and that might hinge on how readers see the work, how readers and reviewers end up coalescing around the work, then, you know, you could be very surprised for what lands you in jail or your book in a bonfire.
Especially in a system like the Soviet one, where there what could be physically printed was restricted.
Everything had to be pre.
Yeah, the publication industry was a state controlled industry, like everything. So it wasn't. It wasn't just a matter of them after the fact censoring books. It was that you could only publish a book using the apparatus of the state publishing industry. And so these state censors were, and again, based on a very nebulous set of ideas of right. What passed muster.
There's no rule book the way a movie studio or a TV show could follow a list of, you know, you can't say these words.
Right.
It's really more what gets created in the head of one reviewer.
And what's strange is, of course, that the Russian literary like culture is such a just a crucial, inextricable part of Russian identity, particularly 19th century, 20th century, like the right. the writers.
Everything post Pushkin is, I mean, that's what creates the idea of a Russia, really.
Right. But within this system, even poetry, even the idea of poetry became kind of bourgeois because
it's going to have ambiguity.
Right.
And anything with ambiguity might have a good idea and a bad idea at the same time.
And who's got time? Who is so at leisure that they can write this?
Oh, right. It's even suspect to have something like that that exists.
Right. Because it implies that you're like, there's so many contradictions in this idea because at a socialist paradise, you should be able to get off your tractor and come home and read all the poetry you want.
Enjoying your abundant leisure time.
Right.
But in practice,
you should get off your tractor and read these approved books on the growth of the socialist man or the promulgation of socialist ideals. You know, there, and all of this, one really gets the sense that it's being decided upon by people, in gray suits who aren't really qualified to be making these ideological determinations, right?
Because they're not artists or thinkers in any way.
Yeah, right. It's an extension. As the state expands, it's starting to, spray insulation, it's starting to fill holes where it only because it can, not because there's really need for it, right? This kind of censorship didn't actually advance the socialist cause, and as we're going to see in a second, it precipitated the birth of a whole new publishing industry and artistic movement.
Even. Oh, so we should thank it. This is like saying Trump will lead to great comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
Lenin will lead to great Pasternak novels.
So within the sort of KGB universe, if you remember The Hunt for Red October.
I do.
Yeah. And Montana. Who was the...
I'll never see Montana.
Who was the most dangerous guy on the Red October? Who was the one that everybody was the most kind of afraid of?
There's a government guy there. Is he KGB? I don't know. He's the representative of the central party or whatever. He's the guy who's not Navy.
Yeah, right. And that is a character that is kind of throughout Soviet society, the political officer who's
political officer
outside of the
I
chain
feel like
of
command. Our submarine should have a political officer, right?
Who would our political officer be?
It's just some really second or third generation Bush or Kennedy.
Yeah, right. That just is always standing there shaking his head.
I mean, I don't know what he would be doing. Is he handing out like pins and buttons and
in the
submarine?
In your and my submarine?
Yeah.
No, I think it would. It's probably going to be Aziz Ansari, and he's just going to be shaking his head that our jokes aren't funny. I have no idea what our political officer would do.
I'm in on a U.S. Navy submarine, but yeah, we do need a political officer on the show.
On our show. Oh, yeah. You're thinking American submarines need a political officer.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's kind of
Why
dangerous.
Why don't they have one? Why doesn't Congress just send... That's who it's going to be. It's going to be some junior congressman from California.
Right.
Who's like, yep, I'm on your tour this time, gentlemen.
Yeah, he's like, direct the sonar at the seafloor to see if there's any evidence of Noah's Ark. But in Soviet... political and social society, there were in companies and in government agencies, there was often what was called a first department, which was basically like a political officer embedded in the corporate structure of a oil company or a technology company or a publishing company, right? Where the person was not part of the corporate structure of the business. They were basically a KGB agent. And their goal was to originally, and I think primarily, not to internally censor people, but to be mindful of what would be considered state secrets. If you have a scientific group that's working on something, the product of it at the point at which it becomes proprietary to the Soviet sphere, you need to now maintain its secrecy, maintain its...
That might actually exist in U.S. defense-adjacent industries.
One expects it does, right? And I think probably more and more all the time. The Chinese government is working at many, many levels, and you get a sense increasingly that this is part of tradecraft and part of the way states are competing with each other in a global sense, that it's just because Bell Labs comes up with a new copier technology, it now has national security implications because of the way that it can be used to disseminate Stuxnets. I mean, believe me, I'm way out of my depth here.
We don't want China to be able to resolve their paper jams faster than we can.
Thank you. Exactly.
We don't want a paper jam gap.
Paper jam gap.
But it must have been a weird cultural thing in these corporate, whatever these corporate semi-state entities are, to have just this one guy that everybody hates. Like the HR guy on The Office, I guess?
It's basically HR, except he's coming around.
Except he can have you executed.
He or she, because this was the Soviet Union.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you for your service. Would be going around just saying like, okay, we need, you know, this needs to be stamped top secret, even though this isn't, we're not a military facility. You know, this...
these blueprints.
Yeah, or this cell, whatever it is, the recognition that this is now, that this has political or economic value that is exclusive to the Soviet state. And one of the ways that they did this was they were very careful about monitoring the actual production of documents, so much so that typewriters in the Soviet Union were a closely reserved kind of technology. You couldn't just go down to the department store and buy a typewriter. Typewriters, even as they were manufactured, were, I mean, we see in crime drama
you can stories, match a typewriter.
You can match a typewriter. That's less common now because nobody uses typewriters.
The fake suicide note had the E a fraction of an inch higher than the other letters.
And therefore we know that it was typed on XYZ's typewriter.
That's how Poirot is going to get to the bottom of this.
And that was a trope in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. But the idea that there was a forensic way to identify a particular typewriter, the same way that you could see which gun fired a particular bullet.
Today you can just tell somebody's like Microsoft Word settings or whatever.
Yeah, who would use Comic Sans? Only a murderer.
Inch and a half margins. This must be Ken Jennings.
But this was so true that any typewriter manufactured in the Soviet Union was immediately tested. Samples were taken, and the KGB maintained a paper database of every typewriter in the USSR.
And this is preemptive, like there isn't anything circulating. They just want to know anytime they see text where it came from.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so and this was part initially part of an anti-espionage project, so that if some secret work escaped the blockade, yeah, they could see exactly who was responsible, or at least they could, you know, they could find the office, they could find the desk. And so what that effectively meant was that if you wanted to publish your own poetry, if you wanted to, share a novel that was on some banned list, the KGB could see exactly where it had been produced. You know, that it was it slopped over from espionage to these cultural restrictions, because there just wasn't any way. All printing presses were state controlled. There wasn't a way to disseminate written material that could, you know, contravene a blockade.
Surely you could hand letter it. I guess that's even more distinctive, though.
Well, you could, but in terms of trying to mass produce a work, right? If you're sitting in,
there's no mimeograph technology yet,
right? You can't email out your handwritten thing. the copy machine, the mimeograph is they're in development during this period. But again, those are all state controlled. I mean, the original copy machines were huge and expensive and not.
This reminds me of just being a kid in the '80s and wishing I had access to a copy machine or a typewriter, but you know, ours wasn't that good. When we went to grandma's house, she would let us use it, but
you didn't have a good typewriter.
I didn't have a good typewriter.
Did you? Because I remember the first time I was allowed to use the mimeograph machine
where was it at school?
In elementary school. I was invited into the office, which at my elementary school, for some reason, was always very dark.
I smelled like cigarettes too.
They kept the lights down. And I could sit and hand crank this mimeograph machine, and it had that incredibly powerful smell. Somebody asked me the other day, like, what smells would evoke your childhood the most? And yeah, I think I said
that weird ditto toner stuff.
I said like unfiltered cigarettes or whatever, but no, it probably would be that. When was the last time anybody smelled a mimeograph?
Yeah, that smell's probably extinct.
Yeah, right. Long gone. But yeah, all that. I mean, carbon copies. Did you ever use carbon copies? Did you ever have carbon paper?
No. I mean, I've seen it on forms. I filled out forms in triplicate.
But that would have been a thing probably that went away just in the time between when I was 8 years old and when you were eight years old, that people were routinely making carbons.
Probably big in Soviet bureaucracy, though.
Yeah. And for futurelings, what carbon copy was you could, there was a type of little packets of typing paper that had four leaves in different colors, and you could roll it into a typewriter, and the typewriter had enough strength to type through that first layer, and it had a backing of ink.
The first layer would disseminate ink onto the subsequent layers.
Yeah, and each layer had a ink backing, and you could type four copies of a document on a typewriter, a manual typewriter, so that.
Think of the time savings.
You could put the yellow one in the principal's office. You could put the blue one in your permanent file. You could put the green one in, send it home to your parents, and then the original document would be on the front page.
Ken, you and I both have spoken at great length about how many mysteries of the unknown and unexplained captivated us when we were kids, and some of those mysteries remain unexplained. We were talking about the Bermuda Triangle just the other day. Whatever happened with that? Did we just decide to stop investigating it after all of those planes and ships disappeared? Well, you probably enjoy, as I do, Expedition Unknown, a television show that's now starting its 13th season on Discovery. And lucky for us, there's a podcast called Expedition Unknown, where the host, Josh Gates, investigates unsolved, iconic stories across the globe. This is right out of our playbook. With direct audio from the hit TV show, we'll hear Gates explore stories like the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, which we've talked about on our show, to the location of Captain Morgan's treasure in Panama, which, as far as I know, we have never talked about on our show. But these authentic, roughshod journeys help Gates separate fact from fiction and learn the truth behind compelling stories. And, wait for it, he investigates the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. His investigation led him to the ocean floor, to the skies above, and even the edge of space, to tackle some of the most intriguing disappearances in history. And this is what I've been saying to you, Ken. It isn't just the ocean floor. It goes to the very edge of space. And in the conclusion of his epic investigation, Josh used cutting-edge technology to investigate the Triangle's most infamous shipwrecks and lost flights. Will he find answers to just how the Triangle works, or will it forever remain a mystery? Tune in to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
When the censors first prohibited the publication of Dr. Zhivago, there was within the Russian, you know, the Soviet intelligentsia, a kind of dawning realization that, wait a minute, this is we're missing something. Clearly missing something here, because
like are we the baddies moment? Like they realize it's oppressive now.
Yeah, that this was, well, more than anything, this was a book that they wanted to read, and it was difficult to make the clear connection between the fact that that a book about individual problems was anti-socialist, and the kind of paternalistic idea that therefore you shouldn't be able to read it. And so Dr. Zhivago was originally published in the West. And
Pasternak got the Nobel Prize, I think. Is that right? As kind of a FU to the Soviets?
Yeah, like a hat tip to him. But the demand for the novel within the Soviet Union meant that people started making independently making copies of it. And if you can imagine sitting down at a typewriter and typing, you know, having Dr. Zhivago, a bootleg copy of it here, and sitting and typing it yourself onto carbon paper, or, you know, to make 4 copies of it, or just hand typing it to make a single copy so that now you have 2 copies. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of work, but there's lots of precedent for it in the arts. Plenty of people sit and copy, you know, a hand copy a painting.
Centuries of monks hand copying manuscripts, right?
So it is a thing that in a pre-mass production of words universe wouldn't have been an alien idea. I don't know how long it would sit for you to sit and transcribe Dr. Zhivago.
Like a novel? I have never read it, but I assume it's an epic. I assume it's long.
It's long. But what is
I'm
that?
I'm a fast typer.
If you're a fast typer and you're not actually having, you don't have to think, you just have to transcribe, there are probably tons and tons of people that would think that was kind of wonderful, actually. I mean, and as a writer, how better to know a work than to actually write it again?
That's what you do in art school, is copy paintings till you understand a little better what's going on.
So it became like a way of disseminating initially a few novels that had been given the, like, this isn't safe for public consumption treatment from Soviet censors.
Are pre-electric typewriters quiet enough that you can just tappity tap and nobody will hear you?
I mean,
you're in the office at night. Where are you?
Yeah. It's unclear. I think it's unclear sitting in an apartment building exactly what all that tapping probably is up to a certain point. But this was part of the problem of this culture of creation, of disseminating these books, because there was a lot of, you know, kind of report your neighbors to the authorities if they are
right,
if they're burning the midnight lamp.
I mean, that's
lamp.
What I'm thinking about. The Ray Bradbury solution to this is simpler. Everybody memorizes one book and then you just have to recite it.
Then you become the book.
But, you know, if I want to hear Dr. Zhivago, I mean, for one thing, you know, a library will get 20 copies of a bestseller and people will wait for years to get, or wait for months to get their copy. But if there's only one guy that knows it, what's he going to do? Like, you have to just wait for him to get done reciting it to your neighbor and then he'll come recite it to you?
No, you have a big party. You have 60 people over and everybody sits crisscross applesauce on the floor. And,
if you have a big party, I mean, somebody there's going to be the political officer.
Right.
Turn me in.
And so initially, The few of these works that were first kind of passed around, and obviously this is a thing that's happening within a literary community already. You know, this isn't that these books aren't getting made and passed around the factory floor quite yet. Each copy of Dr. Zhivago that was self-typed on carbon paper is a very valuable artifact. It took that much work. It's like an illuminated manuscript, kind of the time.
Weeks of work.
But then there were, I mean, the first kind of political one of these was Khrushchev's speech denouncing Stalin.
Oh, which, that was not released?
No. That happened within the Politburo, and that was not a thing that was like on the front page of Pravda. It was that was an internal speech, but once the transcript leaked, although it was suppressed, it was very fascinating.
It's like those Nixon transcripts where 20 years later you're like, wow, this guy hated the Jews.
Right.
But it wasn't at the time, it wasn't a press conference.
So at the dawn of it, there was both a literary side of it and a political side. And it was the term samizdat was coined to describe any of these kind of self-published documents.
And samizdat?
Samizdat,
what is that?
It's basically the Russian word for self-published.
The Russian word for zine?
It's basically. And it's and it's in, you know, it's like samizdat is you know, in contrast to gozizdat.
But is dot?
Dot means state published.
Oh, okay.
And then tamizdat, which means published, it basically means published from over there, which means any kind of foreign publication.
Oh, I see. And that would likely be contraband as well.
Right. So tamizdat stuff is, you know, is published in Cyrillic, presumably by the CIA.
It probably means Tom Clancy is dot. That's
Tom
what it's
is not dot. Oh. And then gozizdat is like state, and these words would be, you know, on the title page.
It's like kid tested, mom approved.
Right? I guess gozizdat is on the title page of every state published.
Yeah,
you
wouldn't have to put samizdat on your zine.
And I don't think the CIA says tamizdat on their books.
Well, there must have been a zine like culture, right? Then of people putting out their own little publications. I mean, I don't know if they were periodicals where they were like, here's what the Ramones are up to now, you'd have favorite authors and houses, and you'd know what little coffee houses to go to pick up the new one.
There was a flourishing moment right in this period, about 1960. So there was a third kind of samizdat right at the time, which was a reaction to just the scarcity of state published stuff. So Solzhenitsyn, during this kind of Khrushchev-like liberalization,
slight thaw,
Solzhenitsyn published One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
And that's about the Stalin era, labor gulag. So I guess this is a time when it's okay to say...
It was briefly okay to criticize Stalin, and this was a state-authorized publication, but there just weren't that many of them relative to the demand for it. And so there were samizdat publications of the Solzhenitsyn book, not because they were censored. Why do I keep conflating the two words? Well, obvious reasons.
It's both.
Not because it was censored, but because it was just scarce.
It's because you're always thinking of the word sensual.
I am so sensual.
And you just have a hard time saying sensual.
But all of a sudden, during this Khrushchev thaw, there was a brief explosion of what you would describe as zines. The three most prominent were called Phoenix. There was one called Boomerang. There was one called Syntaxis.
Oh, so they were little periodicals with names, just like a campus poetry magazine or a somebody's talking head zine in 1980.
And they published poetry. They published, they were largely literary, not especially political.
And they were fora, right? You might submit a poem to Phoenix or Boomerang.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they sound like 70s children's magazines.
They kind of do, Like
I always did the
I
hidden
think I
picture.
I subscribed to Boomerang.
Yeah, I was really good at doing the find the hidden objects in Phoenix and Boomerang.
But that Khrushchev thaw went away pretty fast, and by the time Brezhnev came in the 60s, it had the state had clamped down on all these sort of Western, what they considered Western expressions. And in fact,
not only had they clamped down on them, they had probably never existed in the first place.
That's the other thing, right? They're erased from time.
We've retroactively clamped down.
You know, they started to actually accuse poets of social parasitism, because in order to be a poet, you had to be sucking off the life of this, you know, like you're just living as a...
No, that's not fair. Just because every single poet is some lazy, effete weirdo, it doesn't mean we have to propagate that idea.
So this was an era where there was a lot of fear. Well, that's our mental picture of it, right? But there was a lot of fear of just... It was sort of a loose-lip sink ships mentality, except about everything. There are posters that hung in Soviet office places that just said, like, chatting and gossip is akin to high treason. And then in big letters, do not chat! Exclamation point.
You need a bright line, because if people are chatting, you don't want to have the responsibility of trying to figure out how decadent or subversive their chat is. You know, that would be a judgment call.
Right.
You can just ban chatting altogether.
Just ban
chatting. And then you know that nothing subversive is being said.
I think that we should have a big poster in the bunker here that says, do not chat. And we should seriously consider it every day. And then we will go into making these shows confident that we are part of the resistance.
I used to have to think that with my kids, you know, but now instead I just gave them all phones. And that, in effect, bans chat. Never have to hear anything they're saying. Don't have to worry about whether it's nice or mean or when to step in. Just give them a phone.
So at this point, there are so many ways that the government apparatchiks.
Apparatchiks is like typewriter.
Yeah, typewriter. I did that on purpose. Apparatchiks.
You stole my extra syllable. Now I just have a typewriter like a normal person.
I took the E off my letter sweater and I turned apparatchiks.
The schwa off his varsity sweater.
There were paper shortages, and if all these behaviors were suspect, you could.
Oh yeah, it would be a waste of paper.
A waste of paper, and also if you went and bought more than a ream of paper, the paper seller would write your name down in a little book and report you to the local commissar. So,
what if you just have diarrhea?
Nope, wrong kind of paper. Also, I think in the USSR
is no diarrhea.
you would just use leaves, or I don't. I have no idea what the toilet paper situations were.
Reusable birch bark.
We should get. We're going to get probably plenty of letters from futurelings who grew up in pre-Glasnost Soviet Union, and we would like to hear about your toilet paper habits and whether you actually had any samizdat literature in your house.
Toilet paper was a common joke trope in these kind of whispered, you know, humor was a way in which people would kind of react against state censorship, knowing that any kind of chat was illegal. So even though these jokes were never published anywhere, everybody knew the latest joke about the KGB or Brezhnev or whatever. And, you know, standing in line for toilet paper was a big element.
Yeah. Still funny to this day.
The roughness of it, the unavailability of it, you wouldn't have Yakov Smirnov without this joke underground. So
in Russia, paper toilets you.
That's right.
But samizdat, particularly when Brezhnev kind of shut down the liberalization of the Khrushchev era, it exploded in the intellectual circles as a way of increasingly not just sharing literature, but sharing political thought. And a lot of it was handwritten, but a lot of it was typed, often like individual works just retyped multiple times, or if you could get carbon paper, which was in and of itself a commodity, a precious commodity, and this stuff was contraband that you could bring from the West. There became zines and types of samizdat that were in these different genres. So a lot of the political stuff, and that, again, as I said before, like this isn't kind of what we imagine that political dissidents in the Eastern Bloc were all trying to, you know, espouse democracy.
They have policy goals and specific state criticisms and...
And in fact, that was true, but mostly from a socialist perspective. The vast majority of political writings, underground political writings, in the Soviet Union were written from the people saying we are going away from the socialist path.
I see.
And the
because of these authoritarian bureaucracies are betraying the vision that we still believe in.
Right. And part of that is that censorship is antisocialist. This is authoritarian. Mm-hmm. But then there was a sort of subset of Samizdat that was abandoning socialism in favor of democracy, but in most cases was espousing democratic socialism. So it was abandoning like full state control of the socialist enterprise, but still largely believing in the socialist system. Just
maybe a multi-party,
yeah, just
system in which socialism reigns through its, you know, the correctness of its ideas.
I think thinking that the autocratic period was necessary to reset the culture,
right,
and then once socialism was in full flower, it would inevitably trend toward democracy, which is a better method.
We gave it 45 years. It didn't seem promising.
Wash your hands of it. And then there were other, you know, increasingly other kind of Samizdat styles of zine. There were, as I said before, the kind of Slavophile style, which when you think of Slavophilism,
I rarely think of Slavophilia.
You imagine kind of like, little nesting dolls and like, quaint. But in fact, it's the worst version of sort of combination of.
Is it like a racial purity thing?
It's more, and I think you see this a lot in Russia in particular, the idea that the Russian character only responds to autocracy politically.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the idea that democracy doesn't work. And you see this also in Middle Eastern writing. Democracy is a thing that only works in France, and it would never work in Iraq. And there's a Slavic version of that too. That
we need a daddy.
That's right.
That was the name of my zine.
And I remember being the cover model many times.
Thank you for doing that, by the way. A lot of people said no before you accepted.
But yeah, the idea that the Orthodox Church, in conjunction with a kind of like ethnic and cultural homogeneity, that's the true Russian way. And that stuff was very that was contraband within the contraband. You know, it was not really, it was not popular, and it kind of threatened to delegitimize the whole Samizdat.
If you're going to have a zine, at least have a good lefty one.
But there were, you know, there were Zionist zines, and I think
Zionist
even
Zines?
But from the refusenik culture, right, of like a lot of Jews in the Soviet Union that wanted to stay in the Soviet Union, but an awful lot who wanted to emigrate to Israel. And there were two—
That was controlled very tightly, right?
Yeah, two competing kind of zines, but those were also zines that kind of approached it culturally. But by the mid-60s, it was a fully flourishing underground culture. And so much so that the works themselves, the appearance and the tactile kind of feel of these actual books became talismanic. If you look at a Samizdat creation, it has a real vibe. It's you know, it's often hand typed. In order to preserve paper, they would type all the way out to the very edge of the paper.
Well, I was right about the Microsoft Word margins.
Right. Paper itself was
the cheapest paper, probably.
Yeah, kind of onion skin or even carbon paper. If you can think of a hand-bound book.
You're typing four at once.
Yeah, made out of carbon paper. So the act of reading Asama's work became kind of an artistic experience.
Do you find this is true of your reading in general? Like, I sure do. Like, don't you enjoy a book more if it has some tactile thing you like, a typeface you enjoy, or the pages feel, you know, reading a airport sized paperback just feels different than reading a hardcover, feels different than reading kind of an old weird smelling school library copy.
A book with, you know, that roughed edge to the outside edge of the page.
Do you like the decal edge?
I do.
Yeah. It took me a while, 'cause I was like, this isn't very neat. If I turn this in school, I'd get points docked for this, but I'm a convert to that.
In the late 90s, during the typeface and home or self-published or small press publishing revolution
the beginning
era
of home desktop publishing,
there were a lot of books. You know, book binding became kind of a hipster like a trade, I guess, that people were trying to resurrect. And I knew quite a few artists who made books where the written work itself was secondary to the book as a creation. And I remember writing stuff at the time thinking, wow, I would like to publish this as one of these little miraculous books, not because I think the writing itself is even maybe worthy of it, but because the book would be such a beautiful object.
And that's kind of a new... I think that's become newly emphasized as ebooks have become an option. It's the reason vinyl came back, you know, preserve this thing as a fetish object, even though we know there are more convenient ways to deliver the content to you. I was very upset this week when I heard that the producer Scott Rudin would throw staplers at underlings if they didn't use his favorite font, which was Garamond. Ugh. And I was so that really struck me to the core, because I love Garamond. That was always my favorite.
And now you feel it's been politically corrupted?
Dating back to my yearbook editor days. And now I feel like it's ideologically tainted and I'm going to have to switch to Benbow or something.
Well, and the typefaces of these Samizdat works also were, because you were restricted in the way you could print, you know, in your access to certain styles of printing and certain, you know, that the typeface itself became kind of an emblem of the work, of the style.
Like you see that typeface and you're immediately like, this is independent, subversive material.
Right. Which brings us to the nominal topic of our show.
Finally.
The Erica.
6 hours later.
The Erica typewriter, which was a typewriter that had its origins before World War II in what became East Germany. It was a typewriter made by the Seidel and Naumann Company. And it was, you know, one of the, it was a portable typewriter that came in a little carry case and was one of those pre-war kind of industrial objects that was also a thing of beauty. That was the era of the portable manual typewriter. You can picture Ernest Hemingway at a bullfight with his little Smith Corona or whatever it was.
Even in the 70s and 80s when I was a kid goofing around with a typewriter, they often came in these little briefcases like a sewing machine would.
I have a small collection of typewriters in briefcases.
Oh, I'm looking at the Erica right now.
Well, so there are multiple Ericas, but the pre-war Erica, when Germany was partitioned after the war, the Naumann factory was on the eastern side and became an East German industry where, although we think of, you know, East Germany, the DDR as not being like, not the country that was producing the most wonderful sort of consumer products in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they were making some great things.
Luck of the draw. Anything in East Berlin, they got to keep.
And, you know, there are some incredible microphones that were made in East Germany that are you know, kind of prized in the recording industry today.
I would imagine today people would put up with slightly substandard stuff just for the coolness factor of being an odd bit of Cold War memorabilia.
Well, but, you know, as things in the West moved to transistors, you know, things in the East were still using tubes a lot longer. And then it's like, oh, wow, those are better.
Series of tubes.
But the Erica typewriter was And I think, and you can go now and see that there are collectors, there are typewriter collectors. If you want to go on the internet and go down the rabbit hole of typewriter collectors,
I do.
You can, you'll realize that it's basically, you have to use Tor to really see all of the dark web typewriter talk out there.
Are they going
to
be mad at how I pronounce the word typewriter?
Typewriter? No, I bet you there are people that are like, finally, finally, someone is pronouncing it correctly. But there are giant underground caverns of typewriter people out there still like arguing over.
I'm sure that's who we're speaking to in the far future.
But the Erica typewriter and its subsequent sort of the evolutions, the Erica Model M and then the Model 10 and the Model 20, these were manual typewriters that were that were portable in small carrying cases that just had a wonderful feel, a tactile feel to them. But more importantly, they were produced in East Germany, but not individually serial number connected right. to samples and monitored by the KGB.
So you'd have to bring one in to the Soviet Union unregistered, but that would be comparatively easy to do so compared to bringing it from the West, because you just have to get it from the DDR.
Right. You could travel to the DDR and this was a thing that if you were a member of this culture, if you could secure an Erica M. Now, of course, it had to be in a Cyrillic typewriter. And Cyrillic.
Oh, right. I didn't even think about that. The one I'm looking at is Roman alphabet.
Cyrillic typewriters. You know, the Russian alphabet has 33 letters, whereas the Latin alphabet has 26.
They are superior to us.
Yeah. So a Cyrillic typewriter is a different creature, and a lot of the extra letters kind of expand into the region where, like, a Latin typewriter has all this extraneous, superfluous. Well,
even the German one I'm looking at has expanded a little because... I mean, it's got a few oddities. It's a QWERTZ, not a QWERTY keyboard. The Y and the Z are swapped.
Right.
For some reason. But also there's...
they use the Z more in German.
Oh, I guess that's why.
Right.
Yeah, you want... that makes sense. If the Y is the oddity, so you put it down where our Z is. Interesting.
Yes.
But then they also have... you don't build your own umlaut letters. Those each have their own key. So like to the right of the P is U with an umlaut, and then to the right of the L on the home row is an O and then an A. With an umlaut.
I did quite a bit of research into this and could not get through the challenge of Googling that we have these days, which is that you want to find a specific vein of talking on the internet. And in my case, what I wanted to know was, in a situation where you write in a Cyrillic alphabet, but all you have access to is a Latin typewriter.
Yeah.
How do you do it? There must be a way. If you were Russian and you only had a Latin typewriter and you wanted to type a document, there must be a way that through a combination of kind of backspace and then add or backspace and subtract.
You just build.
You could build a Cyrillic alphabet out of a Latin one.
Are you saying that Erica did not make Cyrillic typewriters, or they did both, but people would make do with Latin ones sometimes?
No, Erica did build Cyrillic typewriters. I was just curious... That there must, I mean, there's no way you could take a Latin typewriter and write Arabic or Japanese on it. But there's so much overlap with a Latin alphabet that I wonder, there has to have been a hack. The problem is trying to Google it now. All I found was 1,000 different websites explaining how to load Cyrillic characters into your Mac alphabet program.
I mean, a lot of the Cyrillic, I'm looking at the Cyrillic alphabet now, and a lot of these are not super... compatible.
No, you'd have to modify it somehow, and I'm just not sure whether I'm just imagining that or whether
there's like
possible.
Four different letters that look kind of like a lowercase b, and so I don't know what you do there.
What's interesting about Samizdat is enough of it survived. I mean, by the 80s, the Lenin State Library had a collection of over a million documents that were part of a Samizdat culture. And what was...
Why were those just historical artifacts by the time that were politically non-threatening?
No, these weren't publicly available.
They'd been seized.
Yeah, they were a collection of documents, you know, kept under lock and key. But in a kind of crazy sort of Orwellian way, a lot of the samizdat stuff made its way into the official state, like higher ups, the thinkers of the autocracy, because they had to be reading this stuff to know what to censor.
Well, don't those people always kind of feel they have special rules anyway?
Yeah.
Of course, the peasants don't get this kind of vodka and this kind of novel, but I'm a party member.
It's the Fahrenheit 451 thing, right? Where the firemen all have their special texts, you know, hidden under their pillowcase. But the sense is that the samizdat writing kind of influenced the Soviet mind and vice versa throughout the 60s and 70s. And, you know, there was another explosion that happened around the Prague Spring. I mean, every one of these sort of democratic moments in the Eastern Bloc was accompanied by a kind of literary moment also. And yeah, most of that was happening in this samizdat world. I mean, Vaclav Havel's writing was really popular in this underground.
He was a playwright.
There was the longest one of these zines, blogs, was called the Chronicle of Current Events, and it started in 68, right around the kind of, you know, the global student movements. It lasted all the way into 1982, and it positioned itself as a kind of a WikiLeaks or a political truth teller. They wrote in really dispassionate language about the kind of state suppression of writers, artists, minorities, etc. That they had the kind of following headings. They had extrajudicial persecution was one of their rubrics. Arrests, searches, and interrogations. Prisons and camps.
This is serious stuff. This isn't just cultural stuff.
Right. Persecution of religion. Persecutions of the Crimean Tartars. Persecutions of the Ukrainians and Lithuanians. Like, each issue sought to kind of publicize all this secret state stuff that wouldn't have made it into Pravda. People wouldn't have been aware of it otherwise.
And it had a broad enough readership that it could, like, start to affect thought?
Kind of like the Omnibus podcast, it was popular among a very narrow or very small but incredibly influential group of writers and readers.
It was a cult samizdat.
Listeners, right, exactly. So then by the time of Gorbachev, a lot of the samizdat publications were suppressed in the 80s, and then Gorbachev and his glasnost really blew open the doors. And in the last half a dozen years of the Soviet Union, there was just a proliferation of these zines, and they all had names like Left Turn and Open Zone.
I wonder if they would keep using the old aesthetic and, you know, even though now there's not the need to use some crappy old German typewriter. I don't know if they kept up the look and feel.
Well, within the samizdat culture, it absolutely was true that it became like the experience of reading something in samizdat became its own aesthetic experience. So much so, kind of like the books of the 90s, the self-published books of the 90s. Oftentimes the artifact itself would be greater than its contents. It kind of didn't matter as much what you were reading to a certain kind of thinker as it mattered that it was produced in this way. It was like listening to a scratchy vinyl record where you could listen to something, you know, that's more pristine, but you have it's the analog experience.
The medium is the message.
And there is an analog to this in music. Vinyl records were also suppressed. And so there became rock and roll and all this sort of Western jazz and so forth. there became an underground samizdat music industry in the Soviet Union where they, you remember those little plastic records you would get in a Mad magazine or, sure. you know,
sometimes they would even come in music magazines, yeah. you know, you'd Q or whatever would come with a
little floppy
little LP or
LP. So that became a way in the Soviet Union that people disseminated contraband music, and the plastic that was best suited to this kind of, to having music etched into it mm-hmm. were discarded X-rays. And so whole LPs would be etched into, you know, found X-rays, this, you know, cellulite or whatever, not cellulite, but celluloid, whatever that floppy X-ray film was. And it became those records were called ribs.
Would there still be anatomical stuff visible?
Yes. You could hold the record metal. Up and it would be, and that's why they're called ribs. You could see, you know, a chest X-ray on your Sgt. Pepper album.
So you could hold it up and the doctor would be like, you know, you've got a blockage by the aorta and also the drums are a little low in the mix.
Those became fetish items. They sound terrible, of course.
I would imagine.
But if that's your only way of getting Sgt. Pepper.
Were they bootlegged Western stuff? They weren't homegrown. Oh, okay.
No, a lot of bootleg Western stuff, but also homegrown. I mean, because there was the rock and roll was used to dissent. Yeah. And there were Soviet musicians called bards who kind of did what you would imagine, a kind of acoustic folk telling the story of the Soviets or telling the story of the glorious Russian people.
Plus, there's the time that Billy Joel came to Red Square. You can imagine everybody would want a bootleg of that.
There's actually by that point, I think you could actually get it on. What's weird is that reel-to-reel tape machines were not restricted. Like you could own a reel-to-reel. It was vinyl that was the...
They're hoping you'll record your neighbors.
Yeah.
And that concludes the Erica Typewriter. Entry 424.JB0412, certificate number 37914, in the omnibus. Now, for the loose association of samizdat-like material that surrounds our endeavor, you can go to various places. There's the informal material flying among the futurelings on Facebook and Discord and Reddit and elsewhere. Just look for the futurelings. There is our social media materials at Omnibus Project. A lot of the good stuff is on our Patreon page, patreon.com/omnibusproject, where if you support the podcast financially, you can get bonus episodes, image and visual feed, and then all kinds of even fancier perks for, you know, well-placed party members. You can email us in this era at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. There, we have a P.O. box for physical items. If you want to send us your grandpa's copy of Dr. Zhivago or Phoenix or Boomerang from the old world. I've never seen, I don't think I've ever seen, maybe in like museums I've seen a samizdat document. But.
What's interesting is you can go online and buy samizdat documents. You, as I said, there's a huge market for Erica typewriters, not among samizdat hipsters, but just typewriter hipsters. You have to fight the typewriter hipsters to get to the samizdat hipsters.
Tom Hanks is outfitting you at every turn.
But you know, the typeface of the Erica is so distinctive. And you can find these samizdat books for sale for $100 or whatever. And the books themselves are just gorgeous. I've really considered, I don't want to get into that, but it does seem like something that you could put next to your Braille Playboy.
I do like it. It's not, you know, it's not that different from a Western typewriter font of the time. You know, you could see it going tick, 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 tick across the screen in a 70s paranoia thriller.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
But if you look at it kind of in its onion paper
typed
to the edges best, what's funny is that one of the ways that the Soviet government used to try to censor Samizdat was they made the argument that because a lot of the authors wrote anonymously in order to not get caught, sure, right? The government said that that this was a copyright issue, that the authors weren't getting
royalties,
they weren't getting the attribution, and so the government needed to clamp down on Samizdat because it was a violation of the author's rights.
You know, I'm looking at the font now. It's the lowercase r and the c that have a distinctive little curlicue that I really kind of like.
Yeah,
it's fun. So yeah, please send us your zines of all kinds. We got something mystifying in the mail this week.
Oh,
and literally, I think there, as far as I can tell, there's no enclosure and not even a return name, but it's four kind of weird little mini postcards that kind of have the weird waxy texture of a,
are they stickers?
Placemat or something? They do have some kind of, they do have a backing with a distinctive picture, but I don't think they're stickers. You
toss one over.
You tell me what these are. It looks like maybe the Capitol Building, Independence Hall, their watercolors, and I don't know what these two are. Is this the, what skyline is that? Pittsburgh? No name, so we don't know who has sent us these.
Yeah, that looks like Philadelphia.
Philadelphia? I mean, that's... But they're not all Philadelphia,
no,
right? That's clearly the U.S. Capitol. There's not some kind of domed Pennsylvania equivalent, right? Or is that the art museum?
No, I don't... Hang on. I think they're all Philadelphia.
Then what's the domed building? I couldn't figure it out.
Is it the...
And also, why are there palm trees on the street scene?
It's
a mystery. If the nameless person who sent this in from Little Rock, Arkansas, would like to let us know, I mean,
maybe that is the U.S. Capitol.
Is there some? Is there some explanatory email where somebody said, "Hey, by the way, I just sent you guys some weird sticker things. I missed it, but thank you, sir, for sending us these cryptic."
These are very cryptic, and I have no. Oh, wait, you didn't look at the back.
Well, the back has a... is it a seal? What is the repeating pattern?
Well, look at it. It's, At first I thought it was Tony the Tiger, but I think it's the Esso Tiger.
Oh. I think you're right. That's funny. I just thought it was a floral design, but it's a cartoon tiger. It is the Esso Tiger. So these are some kind of gas station giveaways?
Maybe so. Esso... Tiger Cityscapes. Let's see what that brings up. No.
Here we go. Laminated travel cards. I found them. Here's somebody selling them.
Put a tiger in your tank. Placemat sets. Oh, there it is. They're placemats.
The artist is George Shaw, apparently. I can't think what we would have mentioned.
These just seem like something weird that someone would.
I love them. Thank you for sending these to us, nameless Arkansan.
The Capitol, Williamsburg, Virginia, Independence Hall, Gloucester, Mass.
Well, we don't have a complete set.
No, but these are too small to be placemats, aren't they? I mean, no. They're only the size of a postcard.
The ones I see are, I mean, maybe they're the same image you could get on a postcard, but these are called laminated travel cards. But what does one do with a laminated travel card? I mean, you pick it up at the gas station, but unlike a map, what's it gonna, it's an idea of where to go next?
It's just like collecting shot glasses. How many shots are you ever gonna take out of your collection of 50 shot glasses?
That's why gas stations used to give the better glasses.
So they come in this set of five. Or five or six. How many do we have? Five?
We have four.
So they come in sets of six, two.
Oh, are they supposed to be coasters? No, I don't think they're coasters. Why are they rectangles? I don't know. But thank you, nameless Arkansas resident.
Super weird and great. But, you know, Ken, you and I used our combined abilities to get to the bottom of what those were.
I would not have recognized the Esso Tiger. You can send us your own weird ephemera to P.O. Box 55744. Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, where we are able to publish whatever we want, including Ken's multiple books.
Unreadable books.
Of children's smarty pants stuff.
No one reads them, but they have to be published by force of law.
Well, and
it's
also
my right as a citizen.
No, all your grown-up books that are available in better airports. Have you ever had a book in an airport?
I have. I've seen my book in an airport.
Which one? Map Heads?
I don't remember. Maybe the map one. I remember I was in that bookstore that's not at SeaTac anymore, and I saw my book on the shelf, and I took it out and signed it surreptitiously. and then I messed with some other stuff to put it face out,
yeah,
you know, in hopes that somebody will buy it quicker that way.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to be the last book left in the orphanage. And while I was in there, William Hung was from American Idol, if you remember Mr. Hung,
sure,
was also perusing the same shelf. I don't know what he was doing in.
Looking for his book.
He was also looking at biographies, I guess. And to this day, I've wondered, what if somebody came by and saw us there and thought, the Jeopardy guy hangs out with William Hung now?
Yeah, this cannot be a coincidence.
Only me and William, if you recognize me, knew that it was.
Well, we have no idea how long this ridiculous civilization that would put Ken Jennings and William Hung together in an airport bookstore. We have no idea how long that could possibly survive.
Doesn't seem like a going concern.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.